Welcome to the Center for Internet Security's podcast, Cybersecurity Where You Are. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we are at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or even running a state or local government. Join CIS's Sean Atkinson and Tony Sager as they discuss trends and threats, ways to implement controls and infrastructure, explore best practices, and interview experts in the industry. We are here to bring clarity to these complex issues to bring confidence in the connected world.
Well, welcome back to the Center for Internet Security's podcast, Cybersecurity Where You Are. It's a pleasure to join you again for this episode where we explore some of the topics of the day, trying to bring a little bit of insight, some of the inside stories of how things work, and give you a little bit to work with, to think about, you know, as we all try to deal with this complicated world of cybersecurity. And today's topic is one of my absolute favorites, the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. So we recently celebrated the current year's report was just released, summarizing the prior year's incidents and all the great analysis that goes in it. But we've been this now marks the 11th year where we worked with the Verizon team to take a look at what they've seen in the wild and map it and make use of the CIS critical security controls as really the improvement framework that ties naturally to the observations that we see out there. So I'm joined by three special guests who bring a different perspective. First of all, TJ from the threat intelligence team at the Center for Internet Security. Welcome aboard, TJ.
Hey, Tony. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on again. Looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah, pleasure. And from the Verizon team, Phil Langlois. Phil, welcome aboard.
Howdy. Always a pleasure, Tony.
Yeah, my pleasure. And Charity, Director of the Controls, who's going to try to make sense of this and help us figure out what we're going to do about all this bad news that the Verizon folks have found for us. Welcome, Charity.
Thanks, Tony. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have everybody. So we'll explore some of the background here and some of the ways that we have worked together. But TJ, let me start with you because, you know, we've been working with Verizon on the recommendations for, as I said, 11 years. But I believe even before that, because of our role as the multi-state ISAC, and now more recently as the election infrastructure ISAC, we're also a data contributor. Can you share with us a little bit of insight into kind of what we do, what we see, and how that becomes an input to the Verizon team?
Yeah, sure. So we have a very broad, wide-ranging membership base across the two ISACs. So we're a little bit over 17,000 SLTT organizations at this point. And I think it's really important to note across those SLTTs, they either directly or indirectly touch all 16 federal critical infrastructure sectors. So we have a really, really unique insight into the threat dynamic and the threat landscape out there affecting all of those sectors. And so our contributions to the report is basically on an annual basis, we share completely anonymized threat and incident trends that we're observing across those communities, those 16 critical infrastructure sectors at the SLTT level, which really, unlike a lot of the other organizations out there, CIS through the ISACs has very, very unique insight into. So some examples would be like activity, you know, when did a particular campaign start? What was the end of that campaign? Was it a ransomware campaign? Was it a phishing campaign? Very niche subsectors. So is it like an education K-12? Was it a higher education, you know, university? Was it law enforcement, healthcare, energy sector, state, local government, things like that, right? And we basically provide information across those spaces, and they're incorporated into the report, and it gives again that unique insight at the SLTT level.
Yeah, can you share a little bit more about this anonymization business? Because you know, that's always been one of the barriers, right? How do I figure out what people are comfortable sharing, and even when we aggregate it, what are the issues around that?
Yeah, sure. So when we talk about anonymization, what we're talking about is we have obviously very intimate knowledge of like what specific organization was impacted, who the victims were. And so we strip all of that information out. So instead of saying it was a particular state or a particular local government, we'll just say a state or a local government or a K-12 entity or something like that, right? It's just basically trying to protect the victim, protect the identity of the victim in particular. We just don't want that information out there. And because of, you know, the relationship we have with members, we're always affirming with them, hey, like when you give us your information, it's your information, right? We're just using it to aid you. We're not passing that on in any identifying way. So whether it's with the DBIR or relationships with CISA or any other partner, that information is always safeguarded. And that's why we use that term anonymized threat data.
Yeah, this is Phil from Verizon. And, you know, this is exactly the way we prefer to get our data, right? We know there's trusted relationships in the industry. Quite frankly, we're not super interested in the specifics because all our analysis is done at this higher level of abstraction, right? What we do care about are things like which industry, the organization size, regions of the world, because that really, I think, helps us understand the large trends. And, you know, it's very difficult, I think, for organizations to share that data because sometimes it's seen as airing a little bit of their dirty laundry. But, you know, I think the DBRO is kind of a testament to that. There's a lot of value to being able to look at these large trends. And maybe, you know, you see as my, you know, an organization, similar organizations are facing similar types of trends. And that's why having trusted relationships, like what the ISACs do, is, you know, such a force multiplier because it provides a, you know, indirect route to share information to the industry and to federal partners who also need that information for other, you know, more active stuff.
Now, I think, you know, part of the struggles we had when I was in federal government, I always say in government, we always try to solve the hardest problem first. And so the general sharing problem is like the hardest ever problem, right? Let's just share all we know about incidents, then we'll all get smart. And we'll know what to do. And it never works because of all these issues of the protections on data, the privacy information, and so forth. So, you know, one of the beauties, I think, of the Verizon analysis, right, is that we know what it's for. You know, the purpose is clear, which then drives the data, as opposed to let's collect the data and then see what we can learn. So when you can define the purpose, and you know, both of you really spoke to it well, which is, it's not about you. It's about the community. It's about the trend. It's about the commonality. And so for that, we don't need the specifics of the victim. We need to understand things like, you know, the campaign, the tradecraft, the technical issues. And that allows us then to make a statement that is valuable to everybody. It's sort of a, we all give a little, and what we get back is this much more valuable context. You know, that goes out there. Phil, so tell me about the other data sources that you use. I mean, I forget the numbers, but it was high dozens, as I recall, in terms of different contributors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we normally average about 80 or so organizations that contribute data. And, you know, this ranges from small forensic shops that, you know, work a handful of cases. And we have a lot of organizations that provide 5 incidents, right? But they're great incidents. You know, they have that level of detail. They're still useful, even though they kind of go into this bucket of 10,000 or 20,000 incidents. And then we also have organizations, a lot of federal organizations are also contributing. So CISA is an example of a contributor. You also have different certs around the world, which kind of help us get that global view. So it's just this beautiful mishmash of private and public organizations that have come together and decided that this is a value, right? That, you know, having this common understanding of the cybersecurity landscape is, I think, fundamental to us being able to properly defend ourselves.
And is it's the number and the contributors, is that fairly steady now, or are there new ones coming and going on?
It's it varies back and forth a little bit. 80 tends to be kind of like the regular number. And there's also two types of data we consume. So we have incident data, which is what goes into, you know, our very structured data, which is based on the Verisk framework. So we code everything and it has a very specific definition as to, you know, what are the attributes of an incident. And then we have what we call non-incident data. And non-incident data is kind of like the phishing data, or it's malware data, or it's, you know, it's this data doesn't necessarily indicate that there was an incident, but helps contextualize what's happening. So vulnerability assessment data is one of these data pools. So, you know, it's organizations have a lot of non-incident data, especially in the security field. So there's a lot of contributors that's what they have. And unfortunately, it's, you know, we don't always have the resources to do their data justice. So sometimes we have to tailor back, you know, sometimes we just like, look, you don't have opportunity. You have really cool data. We're a small team. We don't necessarily have the bandwidth to analyze everything. So sometimes there's kind of some ebb and flow. And of course, in cybersecurity, there's a lot of mergers and there's a lot of right. organizations changing hands and such.
So moving targets, we call them, yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I really respect about the work that you guys do is that, you know, we can daydream all day about the data we wish we had, but you guys are working with the data that we have. And so you have to kind of reconcile, right, the quality, the formats, the, you know, what is to be learned, right? So that's I'm assuming that's quite a bit of work up front to make sense of that, and then, you know, think of creative ways. I've heard you guys talk about these things to bring that data together, right? It's not all collected by one collector. It's not all collected through one set of questions or whatever. And so it seems to me there's got to be a lot of work in the normalization, I guess you would call it.
Oh yeah. The you know, we're fortunate with having Veris. You know, Veris is about 13 years old now. And Veris is very much structured to answer the questions that we think are important in a breach, right? Who was impacted? How did it happen? What was impacted? And what was the results? Right. So we kind of consider that the language of the breaches. And, you know, once we have it into that standard language, we have an immense amount of tooling and automated processes that generate hundreds of reports based off of every different subset you can imagine. So then, you know, there isn't really a manual analysis process to go into. We might do, like, you know, a little spot check. Okay, what if I pull out ransomware? You know, what are the specific trends I can see in that? Or what if I pull out, you know, just nation state actors? And we can do kind of these, like, little spot type of analysis, but the majority of it's all automated, because we have that standard that's kind of reinforced throughout our pipeline. However, the non-incident data, that's where you need the really smart data scientists and be able to, you know, specifically go through the data and parse and do all the fun data science-y work. But it also really comes down to having the right question, right? What can help drive better security? And I think we've been able to do some really cool analysis this year with looking at vulnerabilities in terms of patch rate, but then also how long did it take to get, you know, exploited from this as a KV?
Yeah, no, it does feel like a real step up this year. I appreciate that. TJ, so how about your perspective as a contributor now, both analyst, contributor, and then reader, I'm pretty sure, of the work that they do.
Yeah, I wanted to specifically dovetail off of something that Phil said when he was talking about Veris. And I think that's one of the huge value adds that the DBIR brings to the table, is that in Intel and in the cyber community, having a common vernacular and structured terminology around the information flow of threats is, like, one of the biggest things we're still trying to tackle, is every organization ingests information a little bit differently. And I think it's incredible how the DBIR is able to use Veris, kind of get that standardization, and then really provide, like, long-term foresight and, you know, trends and patterns across all the different data sets that they're getting, right? Because our data set's a little bit different. All those other contributors may have a little bit of a different data model when they're given that information. So that having that consistent analytic standard that they're applying is really, really valuable.
Yeah, if you looked at it, again, as sort of actuarial data or statistical data, it's sort of messy. But you guys have done a great job. Again, rather than try to get everyone to collect data the same way, which is going to be impossible, you know, you've found a way through, you know, a mix of analysis, automation, and so forth, to really draw the value out of it without asking everyone to dramatically change their behavior, which is, like, astounding. We don't get to pull that off very often in the business. So, Charity, now you're on you get to read the Verizon report, right? And you're relatively new to CIS, so I'm assuming you would look at it before you got here, and now you look at it as one of our inputs. So just tell the audience a little bit about kind of what it means to you, what role it plays as we think of, at the end of the day, right, we're trying to move people into security improvement programs, right? Not a read the document, be inspired, then run off and do something, but really plan out a thoughtful security program. So tell me about your perspective there when you look at the work of the Verizon team.
Yeah, absolutely. I've certainly looked at the Verizon reports before in years past before coming to CIS, but, you know, I have to give props to the Verizon team because they make it so enjoyable to read. So it really is nice from a practitioner or from, you know, the other side of the house being security best practice recommendations, right? So it certainly does lend to, you know, reading it as a practitioner, as you said, is yes, it's telling you the top five attacks or, you know, different threat patterns. But what I love about that, as well as CIS controls and, you know, some of our mission and motto, is that the work has been done for you. And as a former practitioner myself, that is so incredibly powerful, right? To know, yes, I can read this, I can understand it, I can take it back to my cybersecurity team or, you know, the C-suite that needs to give us the budget to make these recommended improvements. But also that, you know, the work has been done for you. You can be very confident in what you're seeing here and the data that backs it up as well. So I also like to, you know, this year's report, that it goes really into the pathway of breaches and, you know, that different flavor on the open door and how to get in. You know, your ways in analyses was extremely extremely impactful.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, that's been kind of a work in progress for I think the last couple of years in terms of, you know, really looking at breaches in terms of a process, right? It's not just a one and done, and it's not just a collection of top techniques, right? There's a process that goes through. They're applying different techniques and different tools at different steps of the process. And, you know, it's almost like a waterfall. You hit a certain point where it's going to become harder for you to detect. It's going to be harder for you to mitigate against. So if you can catch it earlier on, you know, you're in a better position to really protect your organization. And I think that's, you know, one of the benefits why we like to tie into the controls, because, you know, there's very actionable recommendations that tie back to what we're seeing. So, you know, and that's ultimately what we want to do, is, you know, it's not just doom and gloom and, you know, throw in a few funny jokes and call it a day. We're really trying to provide something that's actionable and something that's directed. And I think one of the biggest selling points, one of the biggest best feedback I've been hearing, is that I'm not in cybersecurity, but I know your report. Because that tells us that we're communicating outside of our echo chamber. And, you know, because when we write it, yeah, a lot, you know, credentials are being abused. I wrote a whole, like, two pages on different types of credential attacks. I don't think I taught TJ anything. I don't think I taught Tony anything. I don't think I taught Charity anything. You guys aren't really necessarily the audience, but it's still that kind of, you know, the ammunition to be able to talk to people that aren't necessarily within our ecosystem. So, and that's always, like I said, one of the difficulties is, you know, like, well, yeah, it's not really necessarily novel. A lot of things we talk about are common knowledge. You know, what are the top three ways into an organization? Credentials, phishing, and exploiting vulnerabilities. I don't think that's a new finding, but the thing is, it's a consistent finding. And I think that consistency helps us, I think, communicate outside of our little world and our echo chamber. And I think that's one of the more important things to do.
Phil, I noticed maybe a dozen years ago, over a dozen years ago, I'm still working at NSA, where I said, I figured out the world was changing, because I would go into like some federal executive's office, right, and be in the waiting room out there. And on the coffee table is the Verizon report. And it was like, oh, this is becoming like Time Magazine. It's just something that is part of the, you know, part of the information, you know, backdrop now. And it does change expectations, right? And it does say, yeah, you know, I mean, number one, I think the Verizon team has been incredibly innovative, you know, beyond the statistics and the technical details. But as you said, it's also important to understand you can't deal with millions of attacks one at a time, right? We absolutely need to understand the most common, right, the reasons why, and these sort of infrastructure. Yeah, I always say that attackers are natural system thinkers, right? They think about attacking the system. There's an old saying in cybersecurity, actually computer security, long before you were born, Phil, you know, the attacker attacks the system, but each defender is just defending his turf. It's something like that, right? Everyone is kind of defending their thing, but the attacker can look across the ecosystem, weak points, supply chains, you know, has much more freedom and naturally thinks about these things more broadly. And the poor defender is hunkered down. Please don't attack me today, you know, and things like this kind of analysis are about looking at the risk to the system, you know, the broadly what is going on here, because none of us is going to solve it by ourselves. So TJ, I have to ask you now, are you also a reader and consumer of the Verizon report? What do you take away from it?
I am, yes, very much so. And I've been reading it, and the CTI team and a couple other, the operational teams at the CIS are regular consumers of the information. And one of the most interesting things we take away from the report is because we have a, you know, more narrow focus on the SLTT sector, and a lot of organizations probably have a similar, you know, problem was that they're looking at maybe the financial sector, or they are having a global kind of look at different patterns in countries. But the DBIR looks across all of those sectors, right? So you can kind of see things that are similar and dissimilar. Some of it's very affirming, like, yeah, I'm seeing that in my sector, and we're seeing that across SLTTs, and like the human element is the biggest element that we deal with. So that's really interesting that that's kind of across the globe type of thing. And then there's other areas where like, that's not the same pattern we're seeing in this particular subsector. So again, it's this idea kind of coming back to, you know, knowing the baseline, what's normal, what's abnormal, even at a scale that's really aggregated at the DBIR level, it's still really interesting and helpful to see the different patterns like that.
Now, as you pointed out, just in quotes, the state locals cut across all the critical infrastructure, right? So, and that's an example of thinking of defense systematically or across the larger system. So they're, you know, because state governments are not a standalone thing. They're deeply embedded in our economy and power and water and every other aspect of our lives. So I think that being able to see, again, both the area that you live and breathe, but also its impact across is a really, really big part of this. Cherry, let's go back to the, you know, so our work with Verizon is part of a larger trend around bringing more rigor and data under the hood to the recommendations that we produce. And we think this is one of the things that really distinguishes our work at CIS, that number one, that we do it, and number two, that we're transparent about it. Any sort of background or thoughts on that and the work that we're doing, like around the community defense model and sort of more broadly about data?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the community defense model specifically, so I see this in three different parts, right? In order to drive, you know, data and fact-driven decisions. And so, you know, you've got the DBI report, which gives you those threat patterns. They've already done the work for you. This is what we're seeing in the environment. This is the trends. You know, Verizon has done an excellent job providing the facts, you know, that base that report. So you've got facts over here in the report itself. And then you've got kill chain like MITRE, right, where it's going to show you the attack techniques and sub techniques, right, that they've already done that kill chain work for you. And it can be extensive, right? And then you've got, okay, well, what does that mean to me? And how am I going to mitigate against those attacks and threats that we've seen in the Verizon report and utilizing the techniques with MITRE, right? And so with the community defense model, we've taken that to a new level, utilizing that information to drive that model. So what that tells you is, hey, if I implement implementation group one with the CIS critical security controls in that group, which there are 56 of those in IG1, you know, where does that put me as far as defense posture against those top attacks, right, that are listed in the Verizon report? So it gives you percentages of how well you are able to defend against those. For IG1, I want to say the last report that we put out is somewhere around 74-75%. And then once you get into IG 2 and 3, you're in the 90s percentage wise. So it really does give the end user and the adopter, you know, no matter what industry you're in, what sector, et cetera, what sized organization, you know, we stand behind the fact that implementation group one provides essential cyber hygiene to defend against those attacks and really gives you, you know, puts the data in your hands. The analyses, again, as I mentioned earlier, is done for you and really puts those decisions at the forefront when you are planning out your cybersecurity program, as well as, you know, iteratively and how you want to improve and mature your program, no matter what stage you're in.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for the audience, that's a bit of an insider look at how we, the kind of discussions that we have, right? We don't just argue about, you know, we should put this in or this, that we're really thinking systematically about these issues of data and value of recommendations and you know, how do we frame them in such a way. One of my earlier discussions today were folks primarily from the insurance industry. And, you know, they love this kind of story, by the way, the interaction between Verizon and us, not because they care about the details, but it gives them confidence that recommendations are based upon evidence You know, and it's not the kind of evidence they have for actuarial tables for life insurance or auto insurance, but it's the best data that we have. And again, it's the, you know, tying together the data gathering, the great analysis with the what are we going to do about it really is a powerful partnership for our force. But so Phil, I have to ask you though, you know, the report is so good. What can you share with us about the insider part of it? Because I have to believe, I mean, given the volume of data, the pressure to get it out on time, and frankly, your relatively small team, it must be pretty interesting to be part of this as you ramp up the analysis and then the writing and the publication. What could you tell us about that you're comfortable sharing?
It's always an impressive process, right? You know, I almost think that we're cybersecurity accountants because we work from November to April, more or less. Gotcha. And, you know, this is all we're doing is we're going through. And like I said, we have a lot of automated processes. But at the end of the day, every incident that goes into our 20,000 or 10,000 bucket gets hand touched in some fashion by two analysts, right? So an analyst does the initial coding, and then there's always some level of review on top of all the automation that's built up. So, you know, and some partners provide us these beautiful databases, right? These database dumps, everything's nicely formatted. You just have to tie back, you know, columns and values and say, this is what the equivalent are. And then some of them are just PDFs and you have to read till you go cross-eyed. But fortunately, we have we're a small and mighty team that have a very good dynamic. And it allows us to kind of shoulder the pain of going through all the data. So we're extremely collaborative, and you know, we share a lot of the work. And of course, you know, we also test all of our dumb jokes on each other. So there's a lot more that goes in the cutting room floor than actually ends up making for the report. Which is probably for the best, because when you're 4 hours after reviewing those PDFs, your sense of humor might be a little bit jaded.
So what I as true, I think Charity said, I really enjoy your report. I think the writing is number one. The analysis is great, but the writing is readable and it's fun. And so, but what you're telling me is you kind of do that as you go, right? The sort of kind of wordplay and things that come up. It's also keep you guys going, right?
Oh yeah, there's no like master plan for humor. It's okay. And I think anyone does programming.
It's the best
yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone does programming, you know, it's a creative art, which obviously so isn't this as well. But you know, the secret is most of the actual writing happens within a very short span of time. You know, a couple of weeks, we crank out the 100 and so pages.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
And then it's, you know, it's the reviews and the double check, you know, double checking each number, which is actually something we have to do. So every single number in that report is verified. So we have a whole fact checking process to assure that what we're putting in the report is correct. Which I think is just very, very good practice in general. But yeah, everything comes together in very short amount of time. So you have all this work, you know, consolidating the data, making sure it's right. And then it's like a very quick sprint, write everything out. And then, you know, sometimes some of us have little lists for the topical things, you know, crack a joke about toothbrushes causing DDoSes because someone had made some mention about that on social media. So you can always kind of tell like exactly when we were writing based on the topical references we were making. Because like a few weeks later, you're like looking at it again, you're like, this is already outdated. Like no one's going to get this reference when this comes out in another couple months.
But well, I have to admit to being a little old for some of your pop culture references, Phil, but the ones I get, I truly enjoy. Now, TJ, I have to ask you, right, in the intense work that your team does, how do you guys have fun? I haven't seen too many puns, I have to admit, in CIS threat reports, but you have to have a way to keep your brain from frying during all the intense work that you do.
Yeah, the team has a really good dynamic. They work really well together. Mostly what we're doing is it's kind of a routine process. So Phil sounds like it's more of a pressure cooker, you know, between a certain confines of months, whereas the CTI team is, you know, it's kind of routine interaction with the threat environment. And we kind of have an interesting line of humor, you know, like we sometimes think, are we a little jaded, you know, seeing the ransomware attacks and seeing everything happen, but we're able to kind of, you know, have a jovial attitude about it and still take it extremely seriously. and be able to kind of muddle through very high pressure scenarios and times. And really, it comes down to just, again, that team dynamic, making sure everybody's supporting each other, making sure that we're seeing the value of what we're providing. That's another really big aspect, is beyond just the DBIR. You know, when we submit anonymized threat data to reports like this, we're also seeing direct impacts in a positive way to our membership. And I think that most of all, the mission and seeing the success of the mission is what keeps the team sane and keeps the team motivated.
All right. Hey, and Charity, I have to ask you the same leadership question. So you've got the ace team working for you, youngish, smart as heck. What about you and your ability to manage the personalities and keep them fired up? Not quite the same deadlines as Phil, but...
Absolutely. I think TJ said it, just, you know, as far as being able to collaborate and have that team cohesion, right? Like, I have a great team that works for the controls, and everybody brings something different to the table, which, lucky for me, is keeps it really fun, really fresh. We've got many different backgrounds, right? From government to practitioner to consulting, you know, really tactical and very deeply technical folks. And so, you know, We provide content, right? We support the CIS controls ecosystem. It's not just about the list. I stole your words, Tony. So we're responsible for bringing different flavors to companion guides and white papers. And we're not quite as funny as Verizon, unfortunately. But that's probably my governance background. But I really love being able to collaborate with everyone. And I truly mean that in the sense of really hearing what the team has to say. And I tell them that all the time. And now that I've been on board for about a year, I think they hopefully get my personality. And it's not just a leadership thing that I just say to save face, because that's one of our leadership principles. But I really do appreciate collaboration and just what everybody brings to the table. And I could go in, and a lot of times I'll go into meetings and I'm like, okay, this is not a directive. It's truly a question. You know, what do we want to do next? What's our next companion guide to support the controls ecosystem? And I love hearing everybody's ideas and what they have to bring to the table. And then it's just, you know, I'm kind of up to us as a team, and then me as a final right head nod on the prioritization of that. But I like to think that everybody is heard, and I really do enjoy it.
Well, you all had great examples. And as Phil said, there's a creative arts aspect to what we do, right? But one, because we need it. But two, it also keeps our brains going and fresh along these. So, Phil, I have to ask you, so the report's been out for a couple weeks now, or somewhere in that range. But so a little bit about the reception that you've gotten, and it's usually overwhelmingly positive. I've never seen anything but also what might be next on the horizon for you guys.
So, yeah, I mean, the reception's been incredibly positive, and you know, which is, I think, which so we'd like to say is the typical norm. But I think this one has really, I think, hit a sweet spot, right? I think it's provided very actionable recommendations. And I think a large part of that is because we've taken a very targeted approach to our research. And, you know, and part of it is, it's always this fine line, because we have to collect the data in advance. We don't really know what the findings are going to be ahead of time, but you sort of, like, in the back of your head, you said, probably going to have to talk about vulnerabilities, because I think MOVEit might have an impact in our data set. I haven't collected it all, but I just have an inkling it might have an impact. So then, you know, you kind of dive in. So, you know, we're kind of building off that, I think, that success and that process. And, you know, that we're going to continue to finesse the things that are standardized and kind of expected, and to really allow us to dive into more of the complex topics, which is where I think that sweet spot is. You know, we're very fortunate. We have some brilliant people working with us. And we also have some amazing contributors, right? We have people that they'll say, what do you want? What data set do you want? We'll make it happen. And that collaboration, I think, is absolutely the key to success of the DBIR. And I think that collaboration, in a very general note, is the key to success for cybersecurity, period. All right. It's not just that, you know, we're quote unquote the smartest people in the room. It's that we can help convince and help collaborate, because we don't, as cybersecurity experts, don't own the whole problem. Right? Verizon doesn't have the whole problem, doesn't see the whole issue, even with the data set it collects. It really needs the outside parties and other folks to kind of join in to help, you know, solve the problem. So we've been extremely fortunate to benefit from that collaboration.
You're exactly right. And, you know, this industry has always been full of the bumper stickers, you know, public-private partnership and rah-rah and all that. But it's actually true, right? We literally, none of us can see the entire problem. And we can't regulate everyone to behave a certain way. It is literally going to take massive amounts of voluntary cooperation, both to understand the problem, but also to make sense of it and then to translate it and execute action. And so, you know, I think we, you know, the work that we do with your team and with others and the work that you do with that big community of data sources, right, are just amazing examples of where people have already chosen to work together. We don't need to have a campaign. You guys just did it and, you know, reached out. There's flexibility on the source end, on the receiving end. You were willing to automate, you know, things and kind of deal with the data that you have as opposed to the data that would be nice and easy. And so that is exactly the kind of community behavior that we talk about a lot at CIS. That is, you know, to recognize you have a common problem, you know, hey, we're all in this together is kind of a bad thing, right? Your behavior affects me, but it's also the opportunity for collective positive action that we don't have to each solve this or learn about it on our own. We can, in fact, do this together. So there's just a really powerful story, Phil, and you know, please pass on the thanks from CIS to the entire team at Verizon, because this is, I think, one of the shining examples of this kind of behavior you talked about. That is, again, it's not kumbaya, bumper sticker, rah, rah, rah. This is real work, you know, concrete, specific, you know, with an output, with a crushing time schedule that you must meet every year. And folks like us, you know, each doing our part to contribute to that and then take action. So it's about as good as it gets. So with that, I'm going to wind up this episode here. There's, you know, we'll have you back and maybe some other teammates of yours, Phil, sometime, because this whole topic of both the data that underpins our decision making and what to do about it, but also the story of cooperation. These are part and parcel of what the Center for Internet Security is all about. And so, you know, it's a pleasure to both share this activity, you know, both the work on its own merits, but also what it stands for. This larger problem and this larger opportunity in front of us. So with that, thanks, Phil. We really appreciate your time. I know you're past the hump of publication, but now you're in the PR campaign of explaining results and already starting to think about the next episode of that. TJ, you know, thank you for the great work that you guys do with the Intel team. Never a dull moment in the work that you do and always a crisis, but you guys are magnificent at it. And Charity, you know, you and your team turning this into actionable, understandable, usable plans. At the end of the day, we need people to improve, right? And they're not going to solve it overnight. They're going to put themselves into a program of improvement. So I think this story helps us craft the right story in a way that makes sense. A boss can even understand and have a copy on their coffee table and feel good about, and we can all move on and one of these days solve this problem. Actually, I'm hoping you young people solve this problem so my retirement check shows up pretty regular. So I need you to get on it. So with that, we'll wind up this episode. To the listeners, thank you again. We always appreciate your time and attention. We know there's a lot of distractions in this business, but please feel free to subscribe to our podcast in the usual ways. We're always open to your suggestions for other topics and other guests. And this has been an extraordinary time with you guys here. So thanks again to my team, Phil, TJ, and Charity. And with that, we'll catch you at the next episode. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the show today. The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS. If you're interested in learning more about how to grow your cybersecurity program, the free tools available to help you on your journey, or to get involved with the CIS volunteer community, visit our website, cisecurity.org. Start secure and stay secure.